is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And happy Monday. Boy, the Citizens Council, the Conservative Citizens Council, the young man who murdered nine people at Mother Emanuel Church, says that in his manifesto, and this website has been tracked, is registered to him. It's fairly clear that this is actually his writing, his manifesto. And a lot of it is not being published or discussed in the media. Instead, it's easier, I think, to talk about should South Carolina take down the racist, traitorous, treasonous Stars and Bars flag. Which, by the way, Mitt Romney, I never thought I would salute Mitt Romney for political courage, for statesmanlike behavior. But he tweeted out over the weekend that it's time to take down the flag, that it's become a symbol of racism. Mitt Romney. The other Republicans, we'll get into that. But it turns out that this kid was, well, actually, I'll share it with you in his own words. As much as I dislike the idea of giving a platform to a killer and a racist, I think if we're going to have any kind of conversation about how this comes about, we need to, for a moment at least, get inside this kid's head. How does this kind of racial hatred grow in a young white man? And ironically, he keeps referring to white privilege without even realizing it. We'll get to that. We'll get to that. But first, the first part of this is basically he, you know, we're all concerned about ISIS recruiting Americans to go over and fight in Syria using their website, or even worse, recruiting Americans to commit murder here in the United States, as has happened apparently a couple of times in the last few months. How is the Council of Conservative Citizens different from ISIS in terms of, you know, recruiting people for hate? This is from this kid. I'm not going to use his name. That's although his name is everywhere and his picture is everywhere. But this is what the alleged killer. Well, yeah, this isn't a news program. This is an opinion program. What the hell? This is what the killer had to say. He posted this on his own website, registered to him. It's called lastrhodesian.com. I don't think the website's still up. But in any case, he wrote, "I was not raised in a racist home or environment. Living in the South, almost every white person has a small amount of racial awareness simply because of the numbers of Negroes in this part of the country. But it is a superficial awareness." Okay. Now, you know, I've pointed out many times that the best part about white privilege is that white people don't have to sit around thinking about the fact that, hey, I'm white. I wonder how that's going to influence this job interview. I wonder how that's going to influence how I'm treated at a restaurant tonight. I wonder how that's going to influence whether I can grab a cab. I wonder how that's going to influence how I'm treated when the police officer pulls my car over because my taillight's out, or just pulls my car over because he feels like it. White people don't think about those things. They don't have to think about those things because the power structure in this country, from its founding to today, is white. But somehow that, you know, for this kid, that he missed that. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, fish not noticing the water that they swim in. He says, the event that truly awakened me was the Trayvon Martin case. I kept hearing and seeing his name, and eventually I decided to look him up. I read the Wikipedia article. That's the one thing I was going to do this morning I haven't done yet, is to go read the Wikipedia article on the Trayvon Martin case. And, Shane, can you find that and print it out, and I'll read it during the break at the bottom of the hour. Because, you know, one of the things I've found about Wikipedia is so very often if there's an agenda, if somebody's got a serious agenda, they will figure out a way to make Wikipedia reflect that. Whether it's, phony baloney arguments about the New Deal or about Smoot Hawley or about tariffs, or it just goes on and on and on. Wikipedia is a fine thing for non-contentious information. You know, if you want to know if colchicine is a mutagen, it's easy to look up. But if you want to know anything that has to do with something that is politically contentious, it's really difficult to know exactly what it is you're reading, which is unfortunate. And I don't have a solution for it. I mean, I support Wikipedia. I think it was a great idea. It's a great thing. But it's open nature. I know that there are right-wing think tanks in this town. I walked through one about 4 years ago. It was more like 6 years ago. There was a bunch of young people sitting at computers, and Wikipedia was up on every one of their computers. They were all editing Wikipedia pages. Now, maybe they've been able to put a stop to that by looking at DNS numbers and things like that. But on the other hand, if they're just using a VPN, they could all have unique DNS numbers and even unique states, locations, countries for that matter. Anyhow, he says, the event that truly awakened me was a Trayvon Martin case. I kept hearing and seeing his name, and eventually I decided to look him up. I read the Wikipedia article, and right away I was unable to understand what the big deal was. It was obvious that Zimmerman was in the right. But more importantly, this prompted me to type in the words black-on-white crime into Google, and I have never been the same since that day. The first website I came to was the Council of Conservative Citizens. There were pages upon pages of these brutal black-on-white murders. I was in disbelief. At this moment, I realized that something was very wrong. How could the news be blowing up the Trayvon Martin case while hundreds of these black-on-white murders got ignored? And then he goes on to say, from here, I found out about the Jewish problem and other issues facing our race, and I can say today that I am completely racially aware. He goes on to say, black people view everything through a racial lens. That's what racial awareness is. It's viewing everything that happens through a racial lens. They're always thinking about the fact that they are black. This is part of the reason they get offended so easily and think that some things are intended to be racist toward them, when even a white person would not be thinking about race. See, here he's explaining white privilege without realizing it. He says, black people are racially aware almost from birth, but white people on average don't think about race in their daily lives, and this is our problem. We need to and have to. Modern history classes, he writes, instill a subconscious white superiority complex in whites and an inferiority complex in blacks. This white superiority complex that comes from learning of how we dominated other peoples is also part of the problem I've just mentioned. But of course, I don't deny that we are in fact superior, he writes. So the Council of Conservative Citizens, this thing grew out of these various councils of white citizens, which first sprang up in the summer of 1954, right after the Brown v. Board decision by the Supreme Court. And they were groups that published publications and things, and the whole point of it all was to educate white people about how important it was to maintain apartheid in the United States, because we were up until 1954, we were legally, well, arguably until 1965, we were legally an apartheid state.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
In fact, I think you could say until the 70s, or maybe, you know, when we outlawed redlining, we were legally an apartheid state, and we're still an apartheid state. Welcome back, 15 minutes past the hour. And Andrea, in Palm Springs, California, watching us on Free Speech TV, on DirecTV. Hey, Andrea, what's up?
Yes, I read over the weekend, I believe it was the L.A. Times, that, first of all, this young man, I didn't even finish ninth grade, and the text of his manifesto was very similar to, and I've been looking for the article, I can't find it, but it seems like there is a hate mongering site that parallels that where it might have been the source for a lot of his
I'm not at all, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if a lot of it was cut and paste,
you know,
or
he adopted it, but what I believe these hate sites are doing is the same thing that ISIS is doing. And if the FBI had been tracking all of their, not just what they're putting on their sites, but their cell phones and things, the way they did with the man in Texas who was ready to kill people, yeah, and caught him and his accomplices. I mean, this guy, this young man might have already been flagged and being monitored if they were as aggressive with these hate-mongering groups.
Right, and when there was a report that was produced for the FBI back in 2009, I think it was, first year of the Obama administration, about, you know, the danger of right-wing extremism in the United States. There,
yeah,
were two, one on left-wing extremism, one on right-wing extremism.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the government pulled it because of the blowback from the right. It's like you can't, it's almost like you can't talk about this stuff. You know, it's you know, Fox News jumps all over it. It gets all hysterical. I mean, it's...
Well, it just is insane, and we've lost... We have lost 50 people to worldwide terrorism since September 11th. But how many have we lost to these hate crimes?
More. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but you know, the number that I had last Friday and I used on the TV show was over 300. But I've got to double check that number because one of my guests said I'm pretty sure that number is wrong, and he was, you know, one of the guys on my side. So
yeah, I think that the pursuit ought to be commensurate with the number of victims that we've had in terms of where the resources are going.
Yeah. Well, and the reality is that there have, you know, with the single exception of 9/11, which was an outlier, throughout the history of the United States, white racist terrorism against black people and the killing of black people has always been greater than any kind of mm-hmm. Muslim terrorism against America, mm-hmm. or, for that matter, left-wing terrorism. I mean, you know, or you know, fundamentalist, the Puerto Rican independence movement has produced a few terrorist acts. You know, it's, but anyway, Andrea, thank you for the call. Yeah, thanks for the call. I wouldn't be at all surprised if even half of this kid's language was cut and pasted from someplace else. But I think that his description of, you know, watching Trayvon Martin, and I'm assuming he was watching it on Fox, although I could be wrong. I could be wrong. But where else are you going to get George Zimmerman's point of view? Right? I mean, Fox was relentlessly promoting George Zimmerman's point of view. Anyhow, we'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. So, you know, I don't want to dig too deep into this thing, but the a couple of other things that he points out. He says, here I would also like to touch on the idea of a Northwest Front. Now, this is something I didn't know about. I mean, he gets into his racial theories, you know, the principal racial theory on the hard right, sort of Jimmy the Greek lost his job for saying it. It's something that I've heard several times in my life. I mean, dating back to high school, from white people, is comparing white people and black people to different breeds of dogs, and he gets into that. But the fact of the matter is, if you want to make that comparison, it would be like comparing a poodle with white hair to a poodle with black hair, because we aren't there are not different breeds of Homo sapiens. There's a different amount of pigment in our skin, and that's pretty much it. And, you know, the science is pretty solid on that. So, you know, you can call white people melanin deficient. And it actually, given your environment, it could be a deficiency. I mean, it's get more skin cancer. But this Northwest Front thing, this is the one thing in his whole rant that I was just completely unfamiliar with. He said, also, here I would also like to touch on the idea of a Northwest Front. I think this idea is beyond stupid. Why should I, for example, give up the beauty and history of my state, South Carolina, to go to the Northwest? Is there a Northwest Front? Shane is nodding his head yes. Okay. So there's a bunch of white people who are moving out to Idaho and Washington State and Oregon and Northern California and maybe Nevada, or at least Northern Nevada, I don't know, Utah. Remember, the Mormon Church would not allow black people to be members for a long, long time, and they didn't allow black men to be priests. And basically every man in the church, if he's a full member of the church, is a priest and lord over his family and will someday have his own planet on which he and his family will reside, according to Mormon teaching, at least as I understand it. And it wasn't until, 78 or 87? It was one of the two that the Mormon Church finally said, okay, the mark of Cain in the Bible, you know, Cain killed Abel and then he got a mark on his forehead so that wherever he went, people would recognize him as a bad guy. And according to the Book of Mormon, that mark is black skin. And therefore, the Mormon Church said, can't have black people in our church, or not as priests, because they have the mark of Cain. Well, they changed that doctrine just, you know, recently. The last 30, 40 years. And they're in arguably the Pacific Northwest, or close to it. I don't know. If you know something about the Northwest Front, call us up. He also got into Jews. This is something, again, I spent some time on some of these right-wing, hardcore, hard-right websites over the weekend. Now I'm going to start getting really weird ads in my web browsing. He says, the problem is that Jews look white and in many cases are white, yet they see themselves as minorities. Just like, and he uses the N-word, most Jews are always thinking about the fact that they're Jewish. The other issue is that they network. If we could somehow turn every Jew blue for 24 hours, and I assume he's meaning so that we could identify them, we could see them. He said, I think there would be a mass awakening because people would be able to see plainly what's going on. Right. So the question, you know, the naked recruiting of young disaffected white people to hate people of color and Jews, and he goes off on Hispanics as well and Asians. The naked recruiting to do this, you know, when ISIL does it, ISIS does it, we call that terrorist recruiting and we arrest people. You know, we try to stop it and we arrest people for participating in it. I realize this is the land of free speech and all that. But when do we say enough? Or do we do it by shaming them? But, you know, our attempts to do that have just largely driven them underground and made them even in some cases more resilient. This is a really tough one. How do we deal with the white racist dynamic in this country, particularly since it has been turned into a political tool by the Reagan candidacy? You know, Reagan back in 66 said that if somebody doesn't want to sell their home to a black person, they shouldn't be forced to, when he was running for governor. And then when he was running for president, the first speech he gave was just down the road from Philadelphia, Mississippi, where Schwerner and I'm forgetting the names, but the three civil rights leaders were murdered. I'm so bad with names. I'm sorry. Where these three guys were murdered, and Reagan's speech was on states' rights, and the Republican Party has successfully over the last 40 years reached out and brought the Southern white racists into the Republican Party to the point that the South is solidly red right now.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
In fact, the head of the Council of Conservative Citizens has been giving money to Republican candidates for some time now. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Okay, I have learned about the Northwest Front, Harold Armstead Covington, who is still alive. He was an American white supremacist activist and writer. Moved to South Africa for a while, lived in Rhodesia for a while. Founding member of the Rhodesian White People's Party. He was deported in 76 after sending threatening letters to a Jewish congregation. After he returned from Rhodesia, he became the leader of the National Socialist Party of America, which is a white supremacist. This is not the, this is the Nazi party, right? National Socialism, NAZ. He lost the primary for the Republican nomination for Attorney General of North Carolina. Very interesting. Very interesting. Anyhow, he suggested, you know, Radio Free Northwest, he suggested that there be a Northwest Front. He's the founder of the Northwest Front, an online political movement which seeks to further this goal. And I got the Trayvon Martin thing off Wikipedia, and it's kind of all over the place. So we have this problem here in the United States of, and several people called and said, why are you calling this man? He's 21 years old, apparently, a kid. And my apologies, careless use of language. This is, you know, thank you for catching it. He's 21 years old. He's a young man. I just, you know, I looked at his picture and thought, geez, he looks like a kid. And I'm an old fart. I mean, anybody under 40 is a kid to me. But that's still no excuse. He's a young man. So, anyhow, Anita in San Antonio, Texas. Your thoughts on this, Anita?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Yeah, this weekend, I just couldn't help but start thinking about the banality of evil.
Yeah.
Hannah Arendt's, I think that's how you pronounce it, book
yeah.
about the Holocaust. And I think we think we recognize evil, like we recognize it now with this Dylan man, I guess it's man. But I think it's, you know, the people who erected these statues, these, you know, and to the Confederate heroes, as they call them, and who just, you know, support continuing to keep up this flag, which represents evil. And I think the people that have pandered to these people and that think like this.
Yeah, across the Republican Party, I would add.
Yes,
tragically.
I think they all have blood on their hands.
Yeah, the Confederate.
I really do.
Yeah, which leads to the whole discussion of the Confederate flag and why is it still flying, you know, next to the state capitol in South Carolina. And, you know, that and people think, oh, it has something to do with, you know, after the Civil War. No, I'm sorry. That flag was put up there in the early 1960s, probably by one of these white citizens councils or by promotion of them or people affiliated with them. In response to the Brown versus Board of Education ruling and all of the discussion that was happening about we need a Civil Rights Act, we need a Voting Rights Act, things like that. And it was just their way of protesting civil rights and school integration, which was starting to happen, quote, forced busing, end quote, I think started happening in the
70s.
I thought it was the 60s, but I could be wrong.
I'd have to
go back, but I think it was during Johnson's administration. But
my question to anybody that thinks we should keep that flag up would be if they feel like that Germany should continue to fly a swastika.
Yeah, the problem is that when you make parallels with Germany, it tends to cause people to just tune out. On the other hand, we have done a marvelous job, we white people in this country, in the United States, over the last in control of the school system, in control of the textbooks, in control of the power structure, in control of the politics, and in control of the media, white people have done a marvelous job of diminishing, minimizing the fact that Mount Vernon, George Washington's home, which is just down the road from here, was a concentration camp. Monticello was a concentration camp. Thomas Jefferson's home, or plantation. We call them plantations. Like there's something wonderful. I'm sorry, they were concentration camps. They were enforced. There was terrorism. The entire South was a terrorist state. It was an apartheid state. It was worse than an apartheid state. It was a slave state. And go ahead.
And that's why I think the swastika is apt. I mean,
yeah.
Because a Jewish person or anybody who had been persecuted by the Nazi regime, imagine when they see a swastika, how that must make them feel. And I think for an African American to see a Confederate flag.
Well, and it's also the flag of traitors who committed treason.
Right.
And who lost the war, it should be consigned to a museum, as President Obama said, as Mitt Romney agreed, as Jeb Bush said he did down in Florida. Anita, thank you for the call. You say the parallels there. Louise and I were to Nazi Germany, to Hannah Arendt. Arendt, or however you say it. I was remembering, and Louise and I had this conversation over the weekend, that in some ways this is very much like Milton Mayer's book, They Thought They Were Free, where he went over after World War II and he interviewed 10, quote, good Germans, a college professor, a baker, a guy who worked in a factory, who, kind of watched the trains going by and didn't know anything about it. And the main message of all of them was, it happens around you slowly enough that you don't realize it until it's too late. And then it's too late to do anything about it because they have so much power and so much force. And I think that's, there is a parallel there. Both with regard to Reaganism, just in the last 35 years, just in the last 5 years or so, people are starting to wake up to how regressive, how our country has gone backwards in terms of the middle class and economics and things. But, and in terms of race. It's this persistent, there's this persistent drumbeat on the hard right about race that is very troubling. It's very troubling. And the question is, what do we do about it? Pat in Mason, Michigan. Hey, Pat, what's up? I used to go skydiving. I broke my back skydiving in Mason, Michigan, Pat.
Ah. Hi, Tom. Love your show.
Thank
you. Love your show. Following this conversation, very sad, saw some of the funeral over the weekend. Another deep sigh from all of us who just are feeling like we just don't know what to do.
No.
I've made many, many calls. Today I made 12 calls to Democratic representatives about a different issue. And I'm my own little, personal activist, but so much I've gone to hearings for various things, and I'm constantly shocked at the lack of real, true representation of those of us who are taxpayers and citizens of this country. And something that just happened recently that just has me, it's a tie-in, but it's not the same. It's not a comparison, only in that I hate to say it, I sound like such a crazy woman, but we have a police state.
Yeah.
We just had a 17-year-old kid killed in the town, in the county right next to mine. He was stopped because he flashed the oncoming car because it was blinding him. Turned out to be a police car. The car swung around, stopped him, and right away, I'm not going to go into all the nitty-gritty, the kid was 17 and did resist giving and doing what he was supposed to do, but he is dead.
Yeah.
He is dead because he didn't, what are they going to put on the license? Cause of death. He refused to give his license and his.
Right, which is now a capital crime in the United States. Not, disrespecting police officers
right.
Is a capital crime. Or asserting your constitutional rights. Pat, thank you. You've and another cop goes free. Thank you for raising that and thank you for your comments. In terms of what do we do, I'm thinking that actually there may be a solution here. And I think that we started down this road and we got maybe 8 or 10 years into it, and then it was very quickly put into reverse. And that is to go back to the ideas of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. Lyndon Johnson pointed out that black wealth in the United States was far less than white wealth. Black income in the United States was far less than white income. That, and that we need to do something about that. And the Great Society, while it wasn't entirely racial, I mean, it was, you know, he was concerned about poverty in white neighborhoods as well. The Great Society was the beginning of a form of reparations. And that's, you know, to this day, black people in this country live in a police state, and increasingly white people too, but for black people, I mean, this is just undisputable. And have, you know, I mean, the average black family in the United States has $5,000 in wealth. The average white family has $80,000 in wealth. There are substantial differences. And what the Great Society sought to do was to balance those things out with affirmative action programs. And you know, it went through the Johnson administration. And then the Carter administration. And then, well, even actually, you know, and continued to some extent through Nixon, actually through the Nixon administration, the Carter administration, and was pulled to a screeching halt by the Reagan administration.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But over the decade following the initiation of the Great Society, we saw poverty in the United States cut by about half and black poverty substantially reduced. And welcome back. Christopher, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Ocean Park, Washington. Hey, Christopher, what's up?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Real quick, first, I used to live in extreme northeastern Washington, right up next to Idaho and Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't call it a northwestern front. I would call it a swamp.
How so?
There are a lot of good people there, but after Barack Obama was elected, I had to leave.
Because?
I moved. They got blatant signs in every window on Main Street.
Really?
About the horrible person who was just elected using racist terms and all those things you saw at the Tea Party, those signs, in
right.
shop windows.
Whoa.
Yeah,
whoa.
So I left.
Yeah, okay.
And I'm white, and I said, that's enough of that.
Yeah, well, good on you.
But I called on about the shooter.
Mm-hmm.
He admitted in court that he killed those people on purpose.
Right.
He's an admitted murderer.
So I don't need to use the word alleged.
Well, he admitted it. He's
right.
a murderer.
You're right. Yeah.
And I prefer the word terrorist like you.
Yeah. And this was an act of terror. And in his manifesto, he didn't explicitly say that. But I think it's fairly clear that that's where he's going. I mean, you know, terrorism is trying to get people to change their political behavior as a consequence of fear. And, I mean, this is exactly what this guy was up to. Christopher, thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing your story. I guess the Northwest Front is there. Benjamin in Madison, Mississippi, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Benjamin, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I think you were trying to come up with the names Cheney, Schwerner, and Goodman.
Thank you. You're right.
Down here in Mississippi. Of course, you know, we know our history down here pretty well.
Yeah.
You know, and I really believe part of the problem of what's going on in this country is that you can't have an open dialogue. Everybody says we need to talk about race. You know, the Attorney General says we're cowards when it comes to race. But, you know, growing up in Mississippi, I've realized that you can't, if you're a white person, you can't discuss that. You can chastise white people. You can point your fingers at, but whenever there's other issues, and there are things that are going on, you're immediately called a racist if you say anything negative, you know, about anyone that doesn't look like yourself. But it's, you know, it's pretty much open season on yourself. I mean, and I think really a lot of this is being driven by, you know, last week you talked about Fox News being divisive. Well, I mean, Tom, in all honesty, you can't come on a program and say white gangs are being formed to to kill black people, and white police officers are out there just wanting to kill black people. I mean, they had to make some liberals' heads explode when they saw the photograph of the white guy going into the church with a gun drawn, not knowing what was in there, you know, to protect black people. You know, you don't hear about that. Now, and we've had another police officer killed this weekend in New Orleans. Another, you know, it's always seems to be a black person killing the cops.
It was a black cop, too.
We're not sitting there saying that there are black terrorists out there going after our police force.
Yeah.
You know, and it's this double standard that you can it's more of a frustration.
So you want the media to criticize black people more for being criminals and thugs. Is that the essence of what you're saying?
Black individuals.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I got it, Benjamin. Thanks a lot. We'll be back. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. We will be, by the way, in the next hour, Phyllis Schlafly is going to join us. We're going to be talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The vote is tomorrow, at least as far as we know. And in our third hour, James K. Galbraith, Jr., or the second, is going to be joining us. And we're going to be talking about the Greek economic crisis and the American economic crisis. And there's a lot going on. And we'll continue on this topic, too. I think we need to revive the Great Society. And you know, explicitly just say, you know, we want to level the playing field now. Black people have been basically under the thumb of white institutional power from the beginning of the European occupation of North America and genocide against the Native Americans until this day, this very day. And we're going to, yes, racially level the playing field, and then let's see where things go. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up?
Well, I just wanted to say, and I think Barack Obama touched on it, you know, in comparing us to other industrialized countries like in Europe, that, you know, there just seems to be something inherently violent in a culture that is, I think, this is my own opinion, but I think we're so dedicated to materialism. We, you know, are so smitten with the meme of, you know, violence to nature. We also practice violence against each other, and we're violent within ourselves. We're at war with ourselves, and this is just an outgrowth of, you know, a crisis in Western civilization. And I suggest that people read God is Red, because Vine Deloria really has a powerful critique that almost makes me cringe when I think that I'm a Christian and how do I approach American Indians who, you know, have a natural religion. You know, they worship nature. Western civilization is at war with nature. The Pope is so eloquently in 75 pages, I just copied it this morning, you know, off my printer. It almost broke my printer. And, you know, 75 pages of critiquing the fact that we have lost something.
Yeah, the Pope's encyclical, the Pope's encyclical reads like Naomi Klein's book, This Changes Everything.
Yeah, and, you know, the thing is, Christianity has, you know, just cowered. You know, I used to be bullied by people like Dostoevsky, who was a Christian, I guess you would say anarchist. But, you know, we have to do something about the structure of society if we're going to call ourselves civilized. And, you know, it's too easy just to, you know, go off and pray and just, you know, turn your back on all these other people.
Well, John,
you know, there
John,
are 8 billion people in the world.
No, I got it. And you know, we have 5% of the world's population. We have over 40% of the guns in the world that are in the hands of civilians here in the United States.
There's a better way.
Yeah.
I mean, I listen to you for that reason. I have been deeply affected by things that you bring up guests that you bring in. It keeps a spark of, you know, sanity alive in my life. And I know in other people, I hear all kinds of very creative, very interesting comments that people make. And we're really, we would like something better than this. I mean, killing and killing and killing. It's just beyond the pale. And, you know, to destroy our own backyard, you know, just leave nothing for the next generation. When American Indians believed we should plan for the seventh generation.
Yeah, at least the Iroquois did. Yes, you're absolutely right. John, thank you for the call.
No, we have a lot to learn from them. We do. We should all read that book.
I absolutely agree. Thank you. Excellent point. And we also spend more on the military than all the other countries in the world combined. And I mean, you know, yeah, we've got a violent streak in this country where we are with Saudi Arabia and North Korea in having the death penalty. I mean, if we were to simply say, you know, we're going to adopt European standards for gun control and we're going to adopt European standards for policing and imprisonment, I think it would go a long way toward altering American society in a positive way. But, you know, it's like there's so many vested interests who make so much money off the crime industry, the private prison industry, the weapons industry, that, you know, no politician is willing to stand up to that. Vinette in New Orleans. Hey, Vinette, thanks for watching and free speech.
Thanks. Hey, Tom. Yeah, I just, you know, you talk a lot about the media and how they control the message. And I wanted to make sure that somebody brought up the Meet the Press issue that happened yesterday. I don't know if you saw it, but it was pretty. I mean, it was like I didn't know whether to laugh or cry.
I didn't see it, but I did read about. I'm assuming that what you're talking about is that they did this thing where they went into a prison and interviewed a whole bunch of murderers on death row, and then, you know, played the interviews on TV, and every single one of them was a black guy.
And more importantly than that, the setup to it was that. Todd was saying, well, you know, let's look at the other side of this. Let's look at this from the perpetrators, and let's remember that this is not a color-blind issue, that this is a color-blind issue. And then every single person on there happened to be African-American, and I thought, well, and luckily, Gene Robinson was on it. He immediately jumped in before anybody else could say anything and was like, you know, we've just talked about a white guy who, you know, killed African-Americans in a church and two white murderers who nobody seems to be able to find, and then all you show are black people, and I don't remember exactly what Chuck Todd said, but it was something like, oh, well, you know, that was just a coincidence. That didn't,
right.
That doesn't mean anything.
Yeah. Yeah, I
thought that was something that you, you know.
It was just astonishingly badly produced, you know, assuming
yeah.
The segment producer or the package producer or whatever title it was, the person who put that thing together and supervised those interviews, assuming that person wasn't just openly racist and trying to make a point, but rather was just, you know, maybe they interviewed a bunch of white people who were not as articulate as the black people were or whatever. They were just looking for the best interviews. But somebody should have said, hey, wait a minute. You know, this is out of balance. Vinette, thank you for calling and pointing that out. I appreciate the call. You know, Meet the Press is not always the most balanced program, shall we say. In fact, usually I call it Meet the Republicans, because that's typically what it is. We'll be back with Phyllis Schlafly, and we're going to continue our conversation about race in America as well. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Just got an email from Lori Wallach of TradeWatch, Public Citizen, citizen.org, who points out that Mark Ruffalo, who has portrayed the Marvel Comics character Dr. Bruce Banner and the Hulk in the Avengers, is the climate change advocate who just happens to be against fast-track the TPP. He just issued a statement. And in part, he says, thanks to leaks, we know that the TPP would empower foreign corporations to challenge our sovereign laws that protect the environment and protect our citizens by dragging the U.S. government to tribunals where corporate lawyers serve as judges. These tribunals would be empowered to order the U.S. government to pay corporations that claim our laws violate their new TPP rights unlimited taxpayer compensation for their future lost profits. In my own state of New York, where hundreds of thousands of people work together to get a ban on fracking, we could be sued for billions of dollars for protecting our communities. And this is not a hypothetical threat. Already, under a narrower version of these rules, the Lone Pine Corporation has sued the government of Canada, demanding hundreds of millions of dollars in compensation for a moratorium on fracking under the St. Lawrence Seaway. Even more insidious, Representative Paul Ryan, climate science denier, added language to the fast-track authority that would block any action on climate change and trade agreements for the next 6 years. With us on the line, as promised, is Phyllis Schlafly, constitutional lawyer, conservative activist, author and speaker, founder of the Eagle Forum. EagleForum.org is the website. And Mrs. Schlafly, welcome back to the program.
Hello, Tom. So happy to join you.
Thank you. Thank you for being with us. And I don't know the title of...
Can you hear me?
I hear you just fine. Can you hear me?
Hello, Tom. Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine, Phyllis. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can
Great.
Hear you.
Okay, thank
I'm
you.
I'm glad to hear you, too.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. I don't know the title of your most recent book. I always like to mention that when people who are authors are on. Can you tell
us? Well, it's the updated A Choice, Not an Echo.
Okay, great.
And, you know, A Choice, Not an Echo, the original paperback, was what created the conservative movement. But a lot has happened since 1964. And I brought it up to date with all the shenanigans the kingmakers have been using since then.
Okay, there you go. So you are, you know, as literally one of the founders of the modern day conservative movement, and me as you know one of the more visible spokespeople for the progressive movement. I suspect we are going to find an area of convergence about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and Fast Track. It seems to me that Fast Track is just gutting Article 3 of the Constitution. And the Fast Track does that. And, well, actually, Fast Track guts Article 2 of the Constitution and Article 1, you know, that says, you know, the president shall negotiate treaties and two-thirds of the Senate has to pass them. And then the TPP guts Article 3, which says that our judiciary makes decisions in this country. I'm curious your thoughts on this as a constitutional
lawyer. Well, I think you're absolutely right. And the biggest thing that's wrong with it is that it gives away big pieces of our sovereignty to some global foreign busybodies who want to tell us what to do. They can do all sorts of things under this fast-track law. They can add new countries. For example, they can add China, which is not in it. They can change the rules and pretend to impose them on us. And it is just, I don't understand why anybody would want to give Obama all new power to go into a closet with a bunch of foreigners and make new rules for us.
Yeah, I don't understand it either. And not just Obama. This is for 6 years. We've never had these deals, these fast-track authorities, which were invented by Richard Nixon and were unconstitutional then, too, have, to the best of my knowledge, never lasted more than 2 years. This one will go to the next president as well, who may be a Republican or a Democrat. Well,
it don't matter which one he is.
Matter.
I don't think he ought to have that kind of power.
I agree. So the question, I know how to message this to progressives, and to Democrats, which is, you know, that it's going to destroy workers. Every single trade deal we've had has been destroying the lives of the American workforce, driving down our standards of living, and also makes it impossible for us to have, you know, good, solid things like environmental protection laws, because they can be challenged. Like right now in Canada, this pause on fracking in the St. Lawrence Seaway.
Well, the thing I've been using is when they passed the last one of these trade deals with South Korea, they promised it was going to create 40,000 new jobs. Well, it did, but they were in South Korea. They weren't in the United States.
Exactly. So how do you message this to conservatives? How do you message this to the people who you know, might be watching Fox News or listening to right-wing radio? I know, you know, Mark Levin agrees with me on this. We haven't talked about it, but I've heard this through his listeners. But I'm not sure about the other conservative talk show hosts. And how do we message this to conservatives?
Well, it's difficult because they are swayed by the words. Free trade sounds like a great, wonderful idea for freedom, but actually it's freedom for China, but not for the United States.
Yeah.
And when you have something like this, you need the global busybodies to make the rules and then have people obey them. But the trouble is, we obey the rules and China doesn't. And they cheat us coming and going.
Well, and it's not just,
and it should be obvious that that's what they've been doing for years.
Yeah, and it's not just China. I mean, you know, there's a long list of countries that are doing that, and we're just kind of rolling over for it. It seems to me that the problem, and this appears to me, I mean, just from where I'm sitting, to be very, very widespread in the Republican Party and growing in the Democratic Party, in large part because of these Supreme Court decisions, which have invented doctrines that didn't exist before, like, buying politicians is actually protected by the First Amendment, or that, you know, corporations are, have equal rights under the law with humans under the 14th Amendment, that as a consequence of that, you got these 28 Democrats who voted with the most of the Republicans. There were 50 Republicans who refused to vote for this, to their credit, in the House of Representatives last week. Now it's back in the Senate, and the vote's going to be tomorrow. And it seems to me that the big problem is that these transnational corporations and foreign governments can now buy American politicians. Is that not at the core of this problem?
Yes, I think it is. And you can see that the big money is having its impact. And that's extremely unfortunate. I've been fighting the group that I call the Kingmakers, but they are the ones with the money who try to move their weight around and control things, and I don't believe it. And, you know, Alexander Hamilton was a great, really opponent of what is now called free trade. And now they even want to take him off the $10 bill and put some feminists on. What do you think of that?
Yeah. Well, I think that they should take Andrew Jackson off because he was, I mean, you know, Andrew Jackson did the Trail of Tears. He was a pretty miserable president. And he opposed banking. He opposed the central bank. So take it. Jay, if you're going to put a woman on a bill, put it on the 20. I'm a fan of Hamilton. In fact, I opened my book, Rebooting the American Dream, by reprinting his 11-point plan that he submitted in 1791 to the George Washington administration for trade, including tariffs, that built
Hamilton?
This country. Hamilton, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he was for putting the interests of our country first.
Exactly.
And that's what I believe in, and I believe in American sovereignty and superiority. And when people talk about national defense, I say that's not good enough. We need to have military superiority, and then our friends will rely on us and our enemies will respect us.
Well, I think we have that. And people say to me, well, don't you want other countries to be able to raise their standard of living? And I'm saying that's up to other countries.
It's up to them. That's right.
You know, I mean, let them, read Alexander Hamilton's
right.
You know, 11-point plan. You
got
know?
It.
So anyway, I am asking people to call their senators. 202-225-3121 is the switchboard for Congress. And
give that number again.
202-225-3121. And if you're calling a Republican senator, you may ask them to stop Obama trade. Which is a nice phrase. And ObamaTrade.com is a great website.
Giving Obama more power.
Exactly. And if you're calling a Democrat, say, hey, I want to protect the jobs of hardworking Americans. Phyllis Schlafly, constitutional lawyer, conservative activist, author, and speaker, founder of the Eagle Forum, eagleforum.org. And Mrs. Schlafly, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's been fun to talk to you, Tom.
It's always nice talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So both sides, as conservative as you can get, as liberal as you get, we agree. This is crazy. Call your senators now. Welcome back, Carl, in Crawfordsville, Indiana. Hey, Carl, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Thank you, Tom. I've been wondering if these Congress people are violating their oath of office, why hasn't legal action been taken against those we are voting for the TPP?
Because the only there are two forms of action that can be taken against a politician who violates their oath of office. Well, arguably three. The third one, the weakest one, would be that Congress can police itself. You know, the Congress can kick members out. But the second one is impeachment. But impeachment has to originate in the House of Representatives, and it's just that ain't going to happen. But the first one, the most important, the largest and most important way that we can take action against people who violate their oath of office, and I would say these 28 Democrats did in the House of Representatives, and we'll see if 13 Democrats in the Senate do again. I'm hoping they don't, is in the elections. And the main way to do it is to support a primary opponent.
Yeah, but the trouble with that is it's already passed by the time the election starts.
I know, but things can be unpassed. I agree, it's much harder to do. It's, you know, NAFTA has been around for, what, 20 years now, and everybody has seen how incredibly, insanely destructive it is. We now have an $11 trillion trade debt, whereas before the Reagan administration began, we had a trade surplus. We were the richest country in the world. We were the world's largest creditor at the end of the Reagan administration. We were the world's largest debtor. We are now way beyond anybody else as the world's largest debtor. $11 trillion. I'm not talking about our national debt. I'm talking about our trade debt. This is money that we actually owe to other countries. It's not money that we owe to ourselves, like with our national debt. That's fairly easily dealt with. But the trade debt, you can't deal with that in any way other than changing your trade policies. And these trade policies that are promoted by the TPP and that will be facilitated by Fast Track, the so-called TPA, which is going to be voted on tomorrow in the Senate, these policies will make the situation, even, in my opinion, even worse. So it's like, what do we do?
We can do to get their attention now that something's afoot.
Yeah, I think
will jeopardize them in the future.
Yeah, call your senators. You are in Indiana. You have two senators. I'm not sure who they are. Isn't Dan Coats one of them? I think, or I'm not sure.
Right. Donnelly.
And Tom Lee or Donnelly?
Donnelly.
Donnelly. Okay. Yeah, call your two senators. They're both Republicans, aren't they?
No, Dom is a Democrat.
Oh, okay, great. Well, when you call the Democratic senator, say, you know, please, you know, stop Fast Track. We don't want to give away any more of our sovereignty. And we don't want to lose any more jobs. And when you call your Republican senator, say, I'm calling to ask that you please stop this Fast Track because I don't want Obama trade. And
is there anything you can do to them after they've left office?
No. No, they're you know, the actions taken by politicians while they're in office it's called sovereign immunity. They're protected from prosecution for the actions that they take because assuming that they're legal actions. And this, while it might be a violation of their oath of office to defend and protect the Constitution of the United States, I think that it is not, there's not a specific law. That's really it's more like treason than it is like murder, if that makes sense. Not to the best of my knowledge, Carl. Carl, thank you for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. And please get on the phone, 202-225-3121, and call your two senators and let them know the vote on Obama trade is coming up tomorrow. Not a good thing. We'll be back. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Steve in Chicago. Hey, Steve. What's up? Steve? No, Steve. Let's try Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny.
Hey, Tom. Listen, I was going to ask you a question about the Lincoln administration, but I have one quick point to make before that. I can think of left-wing organizations that I don't consider terrorists at all, that don't bother me. Whereas the KKK, Oath Keepers, the Quiver Movement, the NRA, they all scare me to death. The Weathermen and then later the Weather Underground, even they were very careful about not killing anybody.
Right.
I mean, that's considerate. That's considerate.
Yeah.
Black Panthers, the same thing. The Yes Men, they were fun. The Occupy Movement, they got beat up by the cops. Greenpeace, they get arrested and locked up by Russians. MoveOn.org, Code Pink, these are all worthy left-wing radical, so-called radical groups. Anonymous, you don't want to cross them. It's a good thing they're on our side.
Yeah. Yeah, good point, Johnny. The right-wingers are getting pretty scary. Johnny, thanks a lot for the call. Steve in Chicago. Hey, Steve. Try it again.
Yes, actually, I wanted to comment on a point. Do you hear me?
Yeah, just fine.
Yeah. Yes, I wanted to comment on a point with regard to the South Carolina shooting. And I do think that we do a disservice to our society, with some of these contentions offered up on the part of the certain people on the left that, you know, we haven't moved one iota in 50 years.
Nobody has, to the best of my knowledge, ever said that, Steve.
Oh,
why would you say such a thing?
For the last week to many many stations, especially urban talk radio, and the number of people, understandably, you know, I can't speak as an African-American. I'm not one. But, you know, the views expressed by a great many persons I've heard, you know, would lead you to believe that basically, you know, that white people have just changed from, you know, not lynching black people in public to, you know, a covert kind of racism that really would like to lynch all black people if they could, but, you know, they just can't. But now we see their true colors because one idiot comes out of the woodwork.
I think that one idiot is representative of a much larger movement of idiots on the right, and the right-wing terrorists, particularly right-wing race-based terrorists, have killed more Americans since 9/11 than have Muslims.
Right, and absolutely, I would tend to.
And I would say also that the African American middle class and working class has been hit much more severely than has the white working class and middle class by Reaganomics over the last 35 years. So you can't subtract economics from an equation. I mean, it's
right. Well, yes, and people like William Julius Wilson, considered the preeminent writer on these topics, you know, has talked about the fact that, you know, moving forward, it's more a class issue than it is going to be a race issue. And I think
would that we got to the point where it was just that, Steve.
Well, yes, I think that, again, his point.
But here's my question to you. If the average wealth of a black family in America is $5,000 and the average wealth of a white family in the United States is $80,000, and that's post-crash, it was over 100 pre-crash. And those numbers are a couple of years old, so it may be a little off. But and that the reason for that is that right up until the 1970s, it was still legal for banks to refuse to give mortgages to people of color, you know, who were moving into largely black neighborhoods, and that the GI Bill, while my dad could buy a house using the GI Bill, the black soldiers who served with him in Japan could not buy a house on the GI Bill. So we've got this long history of depriving black people of access to wealth. What's your solution?
Because wealth is because wealth is a function of generational passing on of that wealth.
Correct.
So in other words, you know, my grandfather dies and he has an estate worth several hundred thousand dollars. He has four grandchildren, to each of whom he leaves $100,000. Well, I've got a huge step up. That's a down payment on a nice house in most parts of America. So, yes, you're absolutely correct. And unfortunately, you know, these issues are compounded by the fact that, you know, that you have disparities with regard to, you know, access to education, access to jobs, to the institutions that allow us to build an economic base. And, you know, so when you have bad schools that aren't going to allow people to acquire the skill sets necessary to make a decent living in the 21st century, you are going to end up repeating this cycle. Now, I don't want to get too far off the point because, you know, this is a talk show and I know you have to take other callers. But my point being is that, you know, when you look out at one of these hate rallies, you know, there tends to be, you know, the people who are advocating hate, you know, some white racist group with neo-Nazis, Klan, whatnot, and you have a police line separating them from the protesters who tend to outnumber them 10 to 1, 50 to 1. The vast majority of those protesters are white people, and the police are protecting the hate mongers from the protesters who, quite frankly, want to tear them apart. I think we've come a long way in America where the minority, I think in this case, who find themselves, you know, as that now, you know, are like a wounded animal, cornered. And inevitably, you can expect that a certain percentage of them are going to lash out.
Steve, you could say, you know, this is not Selma where people who are trying to register to vote are being beaten, you know, from horseback by police officers with clubs wrapped with barbed wire. Yes, that's true. However, In those same states, now we have Republicans in state after state passing laws making it harder for black people to vote. You've got Chris Kolbach, who is the Secretary of State for Kansas, compiling this huge database of voters across multiple states so that people who have common names will be flagged as voting in multiple states and they'll just get routinely knocked off the voting rolls. Jeb Bush had Catherine Harris knock 80,000 African Americans off the voting rolls in Florida 3 weeks before his brother ran for president in 2000.
And I agree with you entirely. Now the question there though becomes, you know, is it the case that it was a targeting of African Americans because they're African Americans?
Of course it was.
Targeting of African. Wait.
No, it's a targeting of Democratic voters.
Right.
And exactly. Yeah, because they're also targeting students, and they're also targeting older people who are on Social Security.
Right, absolutely. So, and if they could have targeted white people, they would have done so if it were just as easy.
Well, like I said, they're targeting young white people, and they're targeting old white people. They're targeting Democratic voters, but they're aggressively targeting black people. And I think the solution is, A, we need to air this out and disinfect it, and B, we need to look once again at the Great Society.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
We need reparations in the form of a rational program to bring bring poor folks across the board up to the middle class.
And now for something completely
crazy. You so crazy.
You're crazy.
This is crazy. This is crazy. This is crazy.
Oh, now you're just being crazy.
It's our crazy alert for the day. Oh, actually, I got a couple here for you. Officials at Utah Valley University said a staircase with a designated texting lane made famous in viral photos has received positive feedback from students. It's the staircase at the Orange School Student Life and Wellness Center is marked with separate lanes labeled walk, run, and text to accommodate the different speeds of students. Amazing. You know, I confess, I was walking down G Street here in Washington D.C. maybe a month or so ago, and I got a text from I think it was Louise. I got a text from somebody, and I pulled out my phone and I was texting back, and I walked right into somebody. Just bang! You know, like, whoa! Don't do that, right? If you're gonna text, stop. Lean against a building. And then number two, you know, this is, I guess this is kind of if I only had a brain. Man arrested on suspicion of burglary over the weekend. This from KETV, Channel 7 News, Lincoln, Nebraska. Over the weekend is accused of only taking two items from a Lincoln home. This guy, he was found passed out in the front lawn of the home. He had a 42-inch flat-screen TV and a package of bacon. Right. Shano is wearing a T-shirt today that's got a pig on it, and it's all divided up into little pieces. And then underneath this is one bacon, two bacon, three bacon, four bacon. It's his bacon T-shirt. Who doesn't love bacon? Well, back when I could eat those Morningstar Farms, they had these stripples, I think they called them, or whatever. It was, you know, it was like fake bacon. Unfortunately, when my gluten intolerance gene flipped on after I got food poisoning the week before 9/11. I haven't been able to eat them since then, but I kind of liked the taste of them. Anyhow, Corky in Hilton, New York. Corky, you wanted to talk about racism in America?
Yeah, this race thing. Yeah, you know, it was pretty well under control in the late 70s, early 80s, when the unions were strong. Because when you... Johnson came out with affirmative action. They had to hire so many African American brothers. You know, they had to hire so many, which was okay. We had plenty of work for them. And everybody was happy. See, when you got in the union, 30 days, probationary period, you were in. After that 30 days, your color went away.
Right.
It wasn't anything to do with color, race, or nationality.
Yeah, although we should acknowledge, Corky, we have to acknowledge
that. In the race,
yeah.
Period.
I think you need
and
to turn me up a little bit.
I was working with people,
Corky?
Brothers who, you know, were almost
Corky?
Impoverished before they got the job. After a couple, 3 years on the job making top dollar,
Corky?
Their kids were going to fine colleges. I worked with a guy, CJ. We used to drive 10 hours on the road together. Trucks talking back and forth on the CB.
Yeah. Yeah.
In 10 hours, you can get a lot of things covered.
Yeah. Yeah. So I agree. I absolutely agree. And the destruction of the unions has done an awful lot to destroy both the white and the black middle class. But I think that we also have to acknowledge that up until the 1960s, that most unions in the United States were actively discriminating against black people. And, you know, that was largely put to an end by the unions themselves through the 60s and 70s. And then the unions came under assault, you know, by Reagan. And ever since then, it's been downhill for everybody.
So yeah, there's kind of two sides to that, but you're right. It's and the decline of the unions has come about as a consequence of the decline of manufacturing jobs, and the decline of manufacturing jobs has come about as a consequence of insane trade policies. And so, you know, what do you do when you what's the definition of insanity? Doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. And from NAFTA till today, all these insane trade policies have led us to an $11 trillion trade debt. And now we're going to sign another one of these things. This is nuts. It's time to call your senator. And thank you, Corky. Nancy, in Fruitland Park, Florida, you did call your senator. You called Bill Nelson. Do I have that right?
Hi, Tom. Yes, I did. Can you hear me?
Just fine.
Okay. Yeah, I did. And I called him at his Orlando office, and I called him in Washington, D.C. And both times, two different people answering the phone, but, you know, they just... They take the information, they can hardly wait to hang up, and they don't even ask me my name. I tell them I'm a Democratic registered Democrat voter in Florida. And they just, they hear it, they listen, and they're like, oh, okay, we're here. And they just hang up.
Well, that's sort of their job. They're not there to debate you. They're there to basically take votes. And you just called and voted, and it will get marked down as, you know, okay, we had 312 calls against and we had 62 calls in favor of, that kind of thing. So,
right, but
don't take it personally.
When it was in the House, when it was in, for Congressman Daniel Webster, the Republican side,
uh-huh.
You know, they actually wanted my zip code and my, you know, my name. They actually uh-huh. wanted a little bit too much information. You know, not really, but I'm just, you know, making a comparison there. It's like, it's unbelievable the difference when you call the Republican offices, which I've called quite a few of them because I get the emails from Congressman Alan Grayson. From Trade Treachery, and he said that to call these numbers, and I called all of them, and the ones that I called was able to get through to you on the Republican side. You know, when you get their switchboard people, they're saying, or their people answer the phone, they're saying, what's your name? What's your zip code? All this kind of stuff, you know. So anyway, they're a little bit more inclusive.
So when you call Bill Nelson, Bill Nelson's a Democrat?
He's a Democrat in Florida. Yeah, and he's a representative of both state. I don't know how it works. I used to vote for him when I lived in South Florida, and now I'm voting for him that I live in. I live northwest of Orlando.
Yeah, well, the senators represent the entire state. So everybody in the state votes for the two senators. So it's in the House that they're broken out into the districts within the state. And I'm curious, was Bill Nelson, do you know if Bill Nelson was one of those 13? I'm sorry, I don't have the list in front of me to be able to affirmatively say one way or the other. If Bill Nelson was one of those 13 Democrats who voted originally in the Senate to pass this thing down to the House?
Yes, he voted to pass it. Yes.
Ah, okay. So, very interesting. Yeah, so our listeners or viewers in Florida might want to call Senator Nelson's office, 202-225-3121, or you can look up his local office probably fairly easily on his website, which I'm guessing would be nelson.senate.gov. Nancy, thank you for the story. Thanks for sharing your experience, and thanks for being enough of an activist to make that phone call. You know, most people don't, and it's really important. Thank you. I appreciate it. Rod in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Rod, you wanted to talk about racism in the Pacific Northwest?
Yeah, hi.
Hey, Rod.
You can hear me?
Just fine. You're on the air.
I'm all confused. Anyway, this friend of mine changed his tune from racism to voting for Obama. I just thought it was a conspiracy there.
What, put the black guy in office and then blame everything on him?
Yeah, kind of like bring up race. It brings racism to a head too. I think they want to stimulate a race war with these killings.
Yeah,
myself, and then to do a right wing takeover. But then I sound crazy.
Well, that's that. No, you don't sound crazy. That is actually the narrative of a novel called The Turner Diaries, which has animated the modern-day white racist movement and separatist movement in large part. And, Rod, thank you for the call. I'll go off on this right now. The Turner Diaries start out with – it's been 15 years since I read it, but and it's rather badly written. It's like reading Ayn Rand, you know. But the Turner Diaries starts out with this guy who, you know, he's a white racist, and he sees Jews and black people and Catholics even taking over the country, and Hispanics, and he's horrified by it. And it was written back in the 70s, as I recall, or that era, maybe the 60s. And so he blows up a federal building, and as I recall, it was in Oklahoma City. I think Tim McVeigh may have picked the building that's in the Turner Diaries. If not, it was one very similar to it. And he kills a couple hundred people. And the federal government in this novel clamps down on him and his movement, which was, the federal government overreacted by trying to take away everybody's guns. And, you know, it's kind of funny. The modern day analogy is that the federal government overreacted to 9/11 by snooping on everybody's phone calls. But in the Turner Diaries, they overreacted by getting physically in people's faces. And those gun owners said, no, we're not going to give up our guns. And they started shooting federal officials. And very quickly, a war of the patriots versus the government happened. And then it became the patriots versus not just the government, but the government and all the people who, in the minds of these white racist patriots, needed or lived off the government, the quote, people on welfare, which in the novel was exclusively black people. Now, in the real world, more white people are on welfare in the United States than black, but forget reality. And at the end of this race war, all the Jews are dead, all the black people are dead, all the Hispanics are dead. I don't know if you got into gays. I don't recall if he was anti-Catholic or not, but you know, the great white Anglo-Saxon Protestants ruled the country, and America was ready to become a great white power once again. And I mean, this is, you know, just like Paul Ryan was requiring his staff to read Ayn Rand's weird rape fiction, Atlas Shrugged and Fountainhead. This is required reading in the white racist movement, the Turner Diaries.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It just doesn't get much more bizarre than that. And yet there are these people who are living their lives by it. It's astonishing. Welcome back. Michael in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hey, Mr. Hartman. Okay. The Northwest Front is a political organization of Aryan men and women, and we all know what that means,
right,
who recognize that an independent and sovereign white nation in the Pacific Northwest is the only possibility for the survival of the white race on this continent. Where are his parents on this? And what are his parents' thought on Aryan men and women?
Well, I've been wondering that, given that his middle name is Storm, and stormfront.org is the principal, white supremacist website out there. Is there an association between those two things? I don't honestly know, but who would give, put the middle name of their kid as Storm? It's got me scratching my head.
That's lame, but still, I'm saying this is why I don't have children, because I could not live with myself if I produced a child and he did what that man did, even though I call him a kid.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's crazy. I couldn't live with myself.
Yeah. Yeah. I have three kids, and I'm glad I did. But the judge was criticized for saying we have two sets of victims here. There's the victims of, the families, the people who are killed and their families, and then there's also the victims who are related to or close to the killer. And I think it was impolitic to say, but I'm sure that he has seen enough of this to know that it was actually true, that his family is probably devastated by this, but maybe not. I mean, maybe this is what this kid was raised for, given that his middle name was Storm. I mean, it's like, where the hell did that come from? I would love to know. I don't think that anybody has been investigating this, the way that it should be investigated. I'm really curious. Michael, thanks a lot for the call. Judy in Lewisford, North Carolina, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. What's up, Judy?
Hi, Tom. I was thinking about President Obama implementing an executive order, if he can, or, of course, have a bill introduced in Congress to talk to kids in school at a very young age about prejudice and racism and all-around hate. And because this is a generation, my opinion, it's a generational issue, and a lot of people who hate live in a bubble.
Yeah.
So that's just kind of what I'm thinking about the issue. And I'm waiting for my Bernie Bear.
Oh, good.
So,
for your Bernie Bear.
I'm really excited. Yeah, we're really excited.
Thank you for
about
supporting
it.
Free Speech TV. I agree, and this is something that Louise keeps talking about. Her life was changed when she was in seventh or eighth grade by taking a Black Studies class in high school or junior high school, and it was required in the East Lansing public school system. We didn't have that in the Lansing schools where I went. I never took a Black Studies class, but Louise did, and she knew things that I didn't know when we met, and to this day will occasionally pop out some little factoid that she learned when she was 13 years old. And I think that Black Studies or the history of racism in America or the history of genocide in America, because I think we should incorporate the Native Americans into this as well, they are the silent victims, and silent in large part because they were pretty much racism and genocide in North America. Judy, I'm with you. Thank you very much for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech and supporting Free Speech TV. It's appreciated. We'll be right back. Ten minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org, and find out what's going on in the world. Victoria Jones is with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
Nice to see your smiling face. What's going on in the world?
The South Carolina legislature will hold a special session tomorrow to debate the status of the Confederate flag flying in front of the State House, according to State Senator Marlon Kimpson. Now, it will require a two-thirds vote to be taken down, although some are saying that actually they could have a vote to change that vote.
Yes, a majority vote could take down the law that requires the two-thirds vote. Yes.
Exactly. Governor Nikki Haley is expected to speak at 4 p.m. today on the issue. The local TV station WIS is reporting that she's trying to find a way to bring down the flag.
Right. And I think one of the things that people may not realize or not remember is that the pastor of the church was Mr. Pastor Pinckney. It was his name, was it not?
Yes, Pinckney.
Yes. Pastor Pinckney was also State Senator Pinckney. And
yes,
so
right.
these members of the state Senate, I saw a white Republican member of the state Senate on Chris Hayes' show last week saying on MSNBC I'm going to sponsor legislation to take down the flag because my friend and colleague was murdered by this kid, by this 21-year-old.
Yes. Representative Brannon is doing that. He said, in fact, that he's spoken to at least 25 lawmakers and all of them have come out to him privately supportive of legislation to change the law. He said in an interview on Saturday that really this flag is sort of like algae, you know, that it's been floating around and it's taken something like this to cause them to do anything about it. He said that it's taken the death of what he referred to as his buddy to cause him to do this, and he says, I should feel ashamed that it's caused me, that it's taken this for me to do this.
Wow, that's a pretty strong statement. What else is up?
Also, the Post and Courier reporter is tweeting that multiple lawmakers have been on conference calls today about the issue and also added that lawmakers feel there is a way to come together and remove the flag.
Yeah.
No,
go ahead.
I'm moving to another topic, so got something?
That's fine. Nope.
Both Israel and Palestinian militants may have committed war crimes during the 2014 Israel-Gaza conflict, according to UN investigators. In a long-awaited report, the UN team said there was evidence of serious violations by both sides. Israel dismissed the investigation as politically motivated and morally flawed, while Hamas said it wrongly equated the victim and executioner.
Wow.
It's a 183-page report, and the UN Human Rights Council highlights the impact on civilians on both sides criticizes Israel for not revising its practice of airstrikes as casualties mounted, questions the type of weapons it's used and the quality of warnings it gave to Palestinians, but it also talks about the number of strikes of Palestinian rockets and the fact that, that some armed groups had released statements indicating they intended to attack civilian targets.
Right. It is so time, as Senator Sanders says, to get moving with a two-state solution here.
Indeed. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled today that a Los Angeles city ordinance that lets police view hotel guest registries violates the privacy rights of business owners. In a 5-4 decision, the court upheld an appeals court ruling that struck down the ordinance that was intended to deter crimes, including prostitution. This is a Fourth Amendment ruling.
Well, that's interesting. Can that same logic be applied to the Patriot Act?
They didn't go that far.
Might this end up at the Supreme Court?
But that would be very interesting, whether it might.
Yeah.
I mean, some people are already speculating that they may have opened the door to other things. I mean, at the moment, it's a question of the cops coming in, demanding to see the hotel registry, looking at people's car models, method of payments and things, you know, because they're snooping to see if anybody's got a hooker in the room.
Right, right.
But anyway, the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do it, cut it out.
Yeah, you've got the right to privately break the law. I mean, you have to be caught breaking the law, but you have the right of privacy until there is reasonable suspicion that you're the guy. And,
yeah, of course, yeah. Get a warrant.
Yeah, there you go. Get a warrant. Yep.
A nonprofit group and the Green and Libertarian parties filed suit today seeking to force open the general election presidential debates to candidates from outside the two major political parties. They filed a suit against the Federal Election Commission. They wanted to crack down on the Commission on Presidential Debates. They argue that's violating FEC rules that dictate that debates must be staged in a nonpartisan manner and candidates selected for participation based on objective criteria. They cited research by a pollster that said an independent candidate would actually need to spend at least $113 million on advertising to achieve 60% name recognition among voters. That's a practical matter, impossible for any candidate who doesn't run in the Democratic or Republican primaries to satisfy the 15% rule, they said.
So haven't we been here before? Didn't Ralph Nader sue back in the day?
I don't know whether he sued back in the day.
I thought he did. And then also there's the problem with the Federal Election Commission is paralyzed. I mean, they're even saying
they're not going
to enforce the law right now because the three Republican commissioners are blocking everything that the three Democratic commissioners try to do.
Yeah, they really need 7, don't they?
Yeah, they really should be an odd number, but it's an even number. And so what can you say?
The man who flew the gyrocopter and landed on the U.S. Capitol said today that he's rejected a plea offer in the case that would have involved several years in prison. He attended a hearing today and he said no, and so the case is likely to go to trial.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, maybe his trial will bring up the issue of money in politics, which is why he flew that gyrocopter onto the Capitol lawn. It's a shame that his issue got lost. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Happy Monday.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us is James K. Galbraith, the economist and Lloyd M. Benson, Jr. Chair in Government and Business Relations and Professor of Government at the University of Texas at Austin. UTexas.edu/LBJ is the website. And Mr. Galbraith, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
Or I should say welcome back. It's been, seems like a year or so, but it's been a while. What's, we're I'm seeing all these headlines about Greece and all this speculation and the countdown to a Grexit, a Greece exit from the European Union, possibly. And, you know, what's going on over there?
Well, at the moment, the governments are, the heads of government are gathered in Brussels to discuss the latest round of proposals. It's been a long and very tiresome process of negotiation and a very one-sided process in which the Greek government has been pressed time and again to make additional concessions, still being pressed to make them, while the side of the creditors have made practically none at all. So this has been an effort to basically force the government of Greece, which was elected on a program of opposing austerity, restarting economic growth, and restoring labor rights, to back down from its political and economic positions.
You know, the form of modern economics championed by your father, I believe, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Was demonstrated by the Roosevelt administration and subsequent administrations to actually work, that we can stimulate an economy by stimulating from the bottom up, and that you can't cut your way to prosperity. It's just never been done. What do the Europeans, and particularly the Germans, who had their debt to Greece cut in half after World War II, what do they not understand about this? Why do they want to continue punishing Greece and driving them further into despair?
Well, let me just clarify one small point here on the question of what happened to the German debt. In 1953, in order to make possible the recovery of the German economy, the German war debts were basically wiped out. Germany was relieved from the Nazi era responsibilities.
Right.
However, the debt owed to Greece was not actually part of that. And so there still is an outstanding loan from Greece to Germany. It was the loan that financed Rommel's campaign in North Africa, which the Germans say they don't have an obligation to pay. On the other hand, their claim is that the Greeks have an obligation to pay every euro cent of the loans that were taken out by past Greek governments for all kinds of purposes, and then taken over by the governments of Germany and other European countries in 2010.
It seems quite hypocritical. Does the average European know that?
You might say that. Yes. I couldn't possibly comment.
Okay. Well, I'm wondering if the average European knows that history.
Oh, I think the average European has long since forgotten that history.
Hmm. Okay.
Or at least has forgotten that the fact of the Greek debt. I mean, they certainly remember the larger history.
I would encourage the
Greeks. I won't even say that. I think the average European is more conscious of this than the European elites admit to. Mm-hmm. You have expressions in German political life by current participants in German politics that the Greek debt, the German debt to Greece, is in fact a legitimate issue.
Yeah.
And there is also an ongoing case of German debt to Italy, which is under discussion by the Italian government.
So these
issues do remain alive at some level in Europe.
So there has been some scaremongering, particularly over the last year, about what would happen. And maybe it's not scaremongering. I guess that's the essence of my question, about what would happen if any of the EU countries were to leave the Eurozone, were to stop using the euro and being part of the Eurozone. And if in this case, Greece, if they went back to the drachma. It looks to me like Greece's economy is relatively small compared to the EU on the one hand, and so it probably wouldn't cause big waves. But on the other hand, Podemos, is, if I'm remembering correctly, is the Spanish equivalent of Syriza, the very progressive group that took over Greece, and they're growing like a weed. So this could become contagious. Isn't that the thing that the EU officials are the most afraid of? And what would be the consequence of the Greeks withdrawing from the EU? And how might that impact Americans?
Well, Greek withdrawal from the Eurozone is something that the present Greek government, which is a left-wing government but a Europeanist government, very much wishes to avoid. And there's no question that while in the long run there might be, it would be a recovery of the Greek economy, and maybe not such a long run, the initial transition would be extremely difficult to manage. You'd have a lot of disruption. And so it's not a step you take lightly. That said, if Greece is forced out of the Eurozone, and the way that would happen would be if the European Central Bank basically decides that it brings basically a lot of pressure on the Greek banking system, closing down banks, revoking the emergency liquidity assistance, which is keeping them alive at the present time, then this action could be forced on the Greek government. And once any country leaves the Eurozone, you've basically ended the notion that the Euro is an irrevocable currency union. And then, of course, other countries would be watching, or the voters in other countries would be watching that experience to see what happens. If it were to be successful, then, of course, you'd have repercussions in Spain and Portugal and elsewhere. But there's also the fact that even if it were not successful, even if it proved to be a calamity, which is entirely possible, that speculators would attack the next country. So whatever happens, the exit of any country from the Eurozone is going to cast the whole enterprise into a great deal of uncertainty.
And what might that do to the United States?
Oh, I think the exposure of the American financial system is at least thought to be relatively small. A disorderly further contraction of the European economy would not be good for the U.S. because it would hurt our exports. And that, I suppose, is a major economic consideration. And the U.S. government is, of course, concerned about having a European partner which isn't distracted by a complete breakdown of its internal system.
Is there not also a concern that some of the European stock markets might begin to collapse, and that would be contagious to the Dow?
Oh, I'm sure that's a possibility. Yes, I would think that. In fact, in the last few days, when they began to be talk about this, the stock market reacted quite allergically, and that spread around the world quite fast. So that would be an effect.
Right. In the last minute or so we have here, if you were advising the Greek government, what would you advise them to do?
I'm hoping that the Greek government holds firmly to the a logical economic position, which protects the weakest people in Greece and promotes the possibility of a recovery from this enormously damaging depression to which Greece has been subjected for the last 5 years. There just has to be a standing up to the extraordinary arrogance and, I would argue, abuse of power that has occurred. That has been the smartest thing for
the Europeans to do would be to stimulate the Greek economy rather than strangle it.
If they were interested in the welfare of Europe as a whole, that would be the smartest thing. But you've got to remember that you've got 18 mostly conservative, austerity committed governments, and they're mostly afraid of having their economic formula proved wrong and having their own citizens decide that another course of action is possible.
And yet in the UK, you've got people marching in the streets against austerity. It's like the people get it, don't they? It seems.
Sorry, yeah. We lost you.
Okay. James K. Galbraith, the economist, and Lloyd M. Benson, Jr., Chair in Government and Business Relations and Professor of Government at the University of Texas at Austin. Sir, thank you so much for being with us there. His Skype went down. Okay, great. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with Anything Goes Summer here on the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around. Welcome back. Carol in Murrells Inlet, South Carolina. Hey, Carol, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I wanted to tell you about my experience yesterday. I went to the service. I'm about 2 hours away from Charleston. So I went to the service at Emmanuel AME Church. I had been planning to go to Charleston anyway because Bernie actually was supposed to have an event yesterday, but out of respect for the slaying, he decided to postpone.
Mm-hmm.
And the event was just lovely, so accommodating. What a great group of parishioners there. They provided, it was very hot. The temperatures have been around 100 degrees every day in South Carolina here. They provided cold water. I mean, they just, they didn't stop providing cold water in the church. They just kept bringing it on and offering to people.
Mm-hmm.
They offered people fans to fan themselves. I mean, it was just wonderful. The vibe was fantastic. There was a lot of hugging. There was a lot of crying, including me. And the guests, I wasn't surprised to see Governor Nikki Haley there or Senator Tim Scott or, you know, Joe Riley, who was a longtime mayor, is a longtime mayor of Charleston. But Congresswoman Maxine Waters was there. I just love her, and I didn't get to really see her, but they mentioned that she was in attendance. So it was just a great event. And then in the evening, I don't know if this made national news, but there was on the Ravenel Bridge a lineup of people holding hands and reportedly 20,000 people. I didn't stick around for that because I was wilted from the morning three-hour service in church.
Yeah.
But the bridge looked fantastic, too, from what I saw in the news.
What was the essence of the sermon that was given? I caught a little bit of it on Melissa Harris Perry's show, but mostly I think they came on thinking the sermon was going to start, and it was actually an altar call, and then I had to go out and do something, and I missed the rest of the show. What was the essence of the sermon?
Well, there were some quotes from scripture. I forget which psalm, but it was very. Very peacemaking and forgiving in the sermon. And, you know, I've been to black churches before in Atlanta when I lived there. It was, I would say, very typical. There was a little fiery stuff. The minister tried to inject humor and... the songs, there were a couple of women from the choir that sang solo songs about forgiveness, hymns about forgiveness and taking comfort in the Lord. And it was just, the killer was mentioned once that he had been apprehended, but it didn't dwell on him at all. It was just mentioned once. Very healing. The whole experience was healing.
That's great. Carol, thank you for the report, and thanks for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Past the hour, your media support group for We the People, the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. And Robert in Missoula, Montana, listening on Progressive Voices. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Hey, it's a great opportunity to get to shed some light on this because I'm a Jew and I live in Montana. I pay attention to what's going on with white separatists, white supremacists, neo-Nazis, and I'm glad you're talking about the Northwest Front. There's probably the biggest message board for white separatists and that crew is called Stormfront.
Right.
And Stormfront is focused in Kalispell, Montana. That's the people who mott and steal with the board, you know, and run everything behind it. And they have been encouraging people to move here for decades. And at this point, Kalispell and both Whitefish are filling up. They're running for local office. And some of them are running for state senate. They're on the police forces. And it's a concerning thing. This is very close to Hayden Lake, Idaho. And I'm not sure if you remember that, where the neo-Nazis had a base set up, and then they lost it through lawsuits.
Is that the group that the Southern Poverty Law Center sued and effectively took their property?
Yep.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly.
That was in Montana.
No, Hayden Lake is just west of us in Idaho.
Oh, in Idaho. Okay.
So they're coming here. This is where Randy Weaver is from. after what happened in North Idaho, he moved over to just below Kalispell. I'm not sure that he lives there now, but yeah, this area is becoming a haven for white separatists, white supremacists, and neo-Nazis.
Wow. Wow. And, you know, if you were to walk down the street of Missoula, well, Missoula is a college town. It's a more progressive.
Super liberal. I'm actually a senator for University of Montana.
Uh-huh.
So I'm very, you know, I'm paying attention to what's going on politically. And
right.
Again, as a Jew, this is highly concerning because I know if we don't open our mouths, the next stop is the cattle car.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's enough people really paying attention to what's going on. They're calling it the front line on purpose.
Yeah. And these guys, including this young man, the shooter, they put Jews and African-Americans basically in the same basket in terms of their hatred. In fact, if anything, they're arguing that Jews are riling up the African-Americans, the blacks, and his phrase, and causing all these problems, right? So I can see where you would be concerned. Do you think that there's a general awareness in the community that this is going on?
No, there isn't. And it's surprising. I do try to bring that awareness up to people, again, because it concerns me pretty personally.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's super aware. There was a radio station, actually, in Kalispell that was very right-wing for a long time, and they got shut down, too, because of a suit. And I can't remember when that was. But, I mean, this is Militia Montana. This is, like... This is ground zero for a lot of where those folks are coming from. And the reasons are there's, you know, it's a relatively clean environment, but there's no minorities here. There's very few African Americans. There's very few Jews. And so they're turning into their own little haven and they're integrating politically.
And the same is true of Idaho and Utah and Washington State and Western and Eastern Oregon.
Yeah, but these guys are much more upfront about it. My daughter lives in Coeur d'Alene, which is actually she just moved to Hayden. And she says that people come to the schools there to, like, you know, see their children. And they've got tattoos and neo-Nazi insignia on them in public.
Wow. Wow. Robert, thank you for sharing the story with us. It's, you know, it's step by step. We wake people up. We inform people. Thank you for doing so. Tony in Santa Barbara, California. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I was just calling to say that I don't know how many people, did you know how active Albert Einstein was in racial politics? And he said racism is the disease of white people.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I just look, having been black for 54 years now, I'm done.
Yeah.
You know, I don't forgive. See, to me, the whole, you know, people will say, well, the forgiveness part is for you so you can live. You know, what kills me is when you look at this little boy or whatever he was, the roof guy, they do a lot of research because most people don't know Denmark Vesey was a minister that helped found that church.
Right.
And he had organized the largest slave revolt that was going to happen of its time. It was supposed to happen June 14th, but then it was moved to June 16th, and look at what he did with the 17th.
Right.
They know the history.
Yeah.
You know, to me, there was a point. So this whole lone wolf thing and all that's BS. They know what they're doing.
Yeah,
and
it was Juneteenth.
Well, Juneteenth was Friday the 19th.
Yeah.
But, you know, when he killed them on the 17th, it was basically a day after when that revolt was supposed to happen.
Right.
What happened to Denmark Vesey, he was hung. He had organized 9,000 slaves. That's what I was saying. This was going to be the largest one ever, but somebody told, of course, and he was hung with 35 other people.
Right.
And so what kills me that the media and everybody else and, you know, trying to take the bite out of this thing is the fact that when we want to honor someone like him that died trying to organize black folks, we are cut down, killed instantly. But anytime that we try to, you know, defend ourselves, and that's all it is the defense thing. Where in history have black folks gone and in mass killed white folks? Nowhere.
Right.
You know, but yet and still, if we want to defend ourselves, then there's a problem. So even all the good people that want to move forward, we haven't moved forward. We haven't.
Right.
I mean, look, we're still dying. When you get through talking after all the vigils and the praying and the walking slow and singing low and forgiving, black people still are dead.
Yeah, and also economically disadvantaged. I'm with you, Tony. The time to forgive, I can't speak, you know, as an African-American, but I would think that maybe the time to forgive is after the situation has been cleaned up a little more. Tony, thank you for the call. Thank you so much. Great to hear from you. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Tomorrow, the Senate will vote on Fast Track. You might want to let your senator know your opinions. 202-225-3121 is the phone number for the Senate switchboard. Welcome back. 28 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Just wanted to point out to you Kemal Benyounas, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing it, lives with his family in Tunisia, has called into the program, he and I have been corresponding in email for some time, trying to get out of the country, trying to get some treatment. He's blind, and he has apparently kidney disease. His most recent update, the kidney continues to hurt. It's like someone has stuck a furnace in it, and quite frankly, it's scaring me to death. I fear going to the doctor because I'm afraid of starting something I can't finish or making more problems. There is a website over at GoFundMe.com/Benyounas Family, BENYOUNES Family. And I don't know if maybe Danielle can tweet that out. GoFundMe.com/Ben, BENYOUNES Family. Something worth checking out. Mark in San Francisco, California. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind? Mark, you are on the air. Can you hear me? I don't hear Mark. Okay, let's try John in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. John?
Yeah, can you hear me, Tom?
Just fine, thank you.
Okay. There were two things that have been on my mind since the, subsequent to the Charleston massacre tragedy. The first was just the outpouring of Christian love and forgiveness by the victims and within the community and across the country. And it's, you know, I think it's just a beautiful unifying force, and I wish it didn't have to be just within a Christian context. But the other thing that is bothering me, the thing that's bothering me is, you know, subsequent to the discussion about the flag and everything, I'm feeling a sort of vindictiveness, or that's not the right word, but hostility toward the South and Southern people in general, you know, and this is not to defend the flag. The flag is a failed symbol, and it shouldn't be endorsed by any government. But I am a Southerner. I live in Milwaukee, but by culture, I'm a Southerner. I can't tell you exactly what that means, but I know it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but
you realize people, that means something very different to a black person whose families lived in the concentration camps that used to be in the South.
Now, hold on a minute here. I live in Milwaukee. I'm an outsider here, except mm-hmm. among black people. When I'm around black people, I'm accepted because I am a Southerner. I share their Southern culture. We talk the same. I'm constantly being told that I sound like somebody's grandpa.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, within the, you know, the white community within Wisconsin, I've never been accepted as a part of it. I'm an other, okay?
Yeah.
But that's not the point I'm trying to get to. The nuance to that is that, yes, I grew up in a racist society, but I live in a racist society, and it's a totally different kind of racism. I think it's a more virulent racism. But racism, I grew up, I'm almost 70 years old. I grew up in East Arkansas in the 50s. I know what that's about.
Right.
But it was a very complicated thing. I'm not defending it by any means. But what I am trying, the point I am trying to make is that people were, okay, the, at the beginning of the, we have talked about the Civil War. The Civil War, only about 30% of the population owned slaves. The rest of them were, you know, tenant farmers, yeoman farmers who didn't have a dog in that fight. They were competing against this industrial, agricultural economy, but they were sold the same kind of bill of goods that was in What's the Matter with Kansas. You know, it's people voting against their own best interest. But there were also, my grandfather was 9 years old when they fled Mississippi because his father was a unionist and had been reporting troop movements to the Union Army. He had two brothers. One was a Confederate soldier. One was a Union soldier, joined up in Mississippi. It's a lot more complicated than that.
I understand, John. Let me lay out a thesis for you, and I'd love to get your take on it. Can we just have a conversation about this rather than a debate?
Sure. No, it's not. I'm not debating.
I would submit to you that when Reconstruction after the Civil War got blown up by which president was it who cut the deal where he said he would basically end Reconstruction? It was like in 1870 something. I'm forgetting the name of the president, but it was before Cleveland. No, it wasn't Johnson or Grant. It was.
I mean, after Grant.
Yeah, it's one of the obscure presidents. But anyhow, he basically put an end to Reconstruction in the early 1870s. And so there was this short period, this little window of about a decade and a half, where the radical Republicans who were white and the African Americans in the South were aligned. And you had actually South Carolina, you know, the legislature being, you know, voted, as I recall, majority black for at least one term. And then the backlash began. And the deal that this guy who became president made was that he would take the Union soldiers, because we were occupied, the North, the United States, was occupying the South at that point in time, in the late 1860s, early 1870s. And was basically forcing racial reconciliation on the South, and was forcing the white power structure in the South to allow blacks to vote and to run for political office. And they did, and they were getting elected in large numbers. I mean, you had some states where you know, and counties where it was majority black, and it was happening. And then in the 1870s and through the 1880s, this whole Reformation process, Reconstruction, failed. It stopped, and he withdrew all the soldiers out of the South, and they immediately went to Jim Crow, and they immediately began repressing the black vote and impressing black people basically back into servitude by passing laws that made just about everything criminal, and then, you know, people ended up in chain gangs. So my thesis here, John, is that we need to finish the process of Reconstruction.
Absolutely. My thesis is that Reconstruction was a busted play from the beginning. Because
okay.
I have correspondence between the general that escorted my family out of Mississippi and his higher command that I would love for you to read.
Hmm.
Because it is so revealing as to what the climate was and the fact that they had no idea what they were doing.
Yeah.
And
Lincoln was dead.
I don't want to make this too personal, but my grandfather was 9 years old when they left, and they were Southerners. They had been Southerners for generations. They were still Southerners, but right. They were also Unionists. And when they returned, they had nothing. And they petitioned the government during a Southern Reconciliation Program. But anyway, my great grandmother petitioned the government for reparations for the property that was confiscated by the Union Army. She got $168. Her husband had died in a refugee camp in Smithfield, Kentucky, Smithland, Kentucky, of smallpox. She came home with five children. Our farm was gone. All our property was gone. And she got $168. It was Reconstruction that solidified the South. It was not, you know, it was not the initiation of the war, which was about slavery. And like I said, most of those people did not have a dog in that fight.
Right.
But they were conscripted, and the
right. And I would submit to you, John, that Lyndon Johnson's Great Society was an attempt to begin a rebooting, basically, of Reconstruction, and at least in part. And although it wasn't limited to the South, it was a nationwide program. But that got then blown up, you know, by Reaganism, and we've never finished this reconciliation process that Reconstruction was supposed to produce,
and
thus
you're
we've
not
got.
Going, you're not going to complete it by vilifying the Southern people, you know, as a whole.
Oh, I agree with you.
You need some of that. You need some of that Christian love that I have seen in Charleston.
I agree with you. On the other hand, you know, having the symbol of basically,
I'm not talking about the flag. The flag has no business being there.
Well, but see, it's still the stars and bars are still on the flag of Mississippi, of the state of Mississippi.
And that's not right. The government should not be sanctioning that.
Okay.
But I lost the thought. Anyway, this has really bothered me because I've been reading online and seeing the comments that people are making. Even some of the comments you've made have disturbed me. I think we need to finish Reconstruction. We need a reconciliation, but you cannot. Oh, here, that's the thought I had was, it's not just the flag. They're talking about removing all the names of generals and all the things. That is part of people's, you know, it's endemic in the culture. It's like the Taliban blowing up the Buddhas.
Well, not quite, but I don't disagree with you that, you know, changing Lee Street to Lincoln Street might be going a little far, but on the other hand, John, thank
you.
You're
listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
On the other hand, tell that to somebody whose great-grandfather was one of the slaves that Lee was fighting to keep in slavery. We'll be back. Welcome back, 15 minutes before the hour, and Bob in Ontario, California, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Bob, what's up?
I know this is a little bit away from the subjects, but in a way, I think there's a constitutional issue involved in what has been taking place with Alex Rodriguez of the Yankees.
First of all, I don't follow politics. I have no idea what's going on with A-Rod. What is it?
Well, here's a man that has tremendous baseball IQ and ability, far beyond anybody I believe we've ever seen play this game, which is a natural thing. His workout regimen was so brutal. There was no one in professional athletics that could stand alongside of him in the off season and actually train with him and be able to do it.
Right.
It seems that accusations. And because he's the only one brave enough to ever admit that he had done something to help his performance, has been held to such a degree against him. And I see this actually basically from one man trying to protect another guy who had set previous records, and that's Bud Selig himself.
Mm.
A-Rod, and as we all know, Tom, we all have a constitutional right to work. Even convicted felons have a constitutional right to work. If something egregious should take place, I think it would have to be something really egregious to take place to take the income away from somebody by a mere accusation. And the mere accusation that was made against Alex Rodriguez is that he was taking some kind of medication that enhanced his performance to achieve the milestones that he has achieved in baseball. And the truth of the matter is, there is no medication, no pill, nothing on earth that can build an A-Rod.
Right.
If there was, we'd all be taking it.
Yeah.
But the truth of the matter, the truth of the matter is this. Any one of us can take any one of these medications by prescription legally. But in baseball, they decided to ban it, like Cialis, like Viagra, like Extends. I have no idea how that is a performance-enhancing drug.
Well, it enhances certain kinds of performance. I don't think it's going to help with baseball. Bob, I get it. Thanks a lot for the call. Fred in Atlanta, Georgia, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Fred. Phyllis Schlafly?
One thing she said about American superiority, which drives me sort of nuts.
I know. I almost said something and I bit my tongue.
Red blood and we have our pros and cons and strengths and weaknesses, and let's not continue to separate ourselves, because that's one of the sources of our major problems.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And I, at that point in time, we had about a minute and a half left in the show, and I really wanted to keep it focused on trade. And she went off on that, and she said, you know, America has to have the superiority and all this. And I was like, oh no, you know, this is.
And I'm not talking about just military superiority, but this whole American exceptionalism.
I know. Every country is exceptional, and every country should have the right to be exceptional. And this is in their own way, their own unique way. And this is one of the problems with these trade deals, is that the corporations are the only ones who are exceptional. And, you know, which I think Phyllis would have agreed with. But in any case, Fred, thank you for the call. We'll be right back. Before they are, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Mark in San Francisco. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I wanted to talk about what happens when we outsource jobs overseas, and
yes,
that is we lose our taxes going into the government.
Correct. Most of the taxes are paid by working people. Yeah.
Yeah, so every time we do that, we're adding to the deficit. So if you
Correct.
Call a Republican, tell them that these trade deals are going to add to the deficit by us losing our tax dollars overseas.
Right. Not only do those folks who are now unemployed and were working in one of the 60,000 factories that have closed just since George Bush became president, not only do they no longer pay income taxes, but now they're receiving government money, typically. They're receiving unemployment benefits or food stamps, or they're qualifying for Medicaid or other programs for the poor. And thus they are draining, you know, money out of the federal coffers. And so it's not just adding to the deficit by loss of taxes. It's also adding to the deficit by increasing government payments. And you're right. That's a very good point to make, except that anybody who's in the pocket of these big corporations, pretty much any of the Republicans and the 13 Democratic senators who voted the last time for this thing, which were Bennett, Cantwell, Cardin, Carper, Coons, Feinstein, Heitkamp, Kane, McCaskill, Murray, Nelson, Shaheen, Warner, and Wyden. What they would say is, oh, but you're not going to lose jobs because of this trade deal. That's the wonders of free trade.
Well, so, you know, Tom, you brought up a good point. The other thing is they want to take $700 million out of Medicare and use it to retrain. So that's $700 million that is going to go as added to what we're losing.
Right. Well, actually, that has been set aside for the moment, and now they're just voting on fast track all by itself. And we'll see if any of these senators, and if one of these people represents you, you might want to call 202. 202 is the D.C. area code, 225-3121. That's the congressional switchboard. Bennett of Colorado, Cantwell of Washington, Cardin of Maryland, Carper of Delaware, Coons of Delaware, Feinstein of California, Heitkamp of North Dakota, Kane of Virginia, McCaskill of Missouri, Murray of Washington State, Nelson of Florida, Shaheen of New Hampshire, Warner in Virginia, and Wyden in Oregon. You might want to call them and let them know that you think that they're wrong. And if you think they're wrong, I mean, if you think that they're right, feel free to call them and tell them that too. Mark, you're absolutely right about the consequences of the. Thank you for the call. Daniel in Santa Paula, California. Hey, Daniel, what's up? Back to South Carolina? Daniel is not there. Gabe in Amesbury, Massachusetts. Hey, Gabe.
Hi, Tom. Hey, listen, last week I heard something really disturbing on Democracy Now.
That was?
You're talking about, what is it?
I said, which was?
Which was what's going on in the Dominican Republic and the Haitians.
Oh, yeah, the mass deportation.
They're passing laws to take a citizenship away from these Haitians in the Dominican Republic going back to 1929. They got the buses all lined up, and they got them all ready to ship them back to Haiti. Like, yeah. These people haven't got enough problems of their own. These people got to deal with this.
And there are some who suggest that this is really racially motivated, that the Dominican Republic has been, you know, they're Spanish-speaking and has historically had a lighter skin Spanish ancestry power structure, essentially, whereas Haiti, on the other side of the island of Hispaniola, was founded actually as the first independent republic in the Western Hemisphere around the 1820s, wasn't it? When the slave rebellion happened and they basically overthrew the power structure and it became an independent state. And Haiti is mostly black, and that most of these people being expelled from the Dominican Republic are black. Is that part of the story to the best of your knowledge, Gabe?
Yeah, that's what I got out of it. And, I asked myself, well, should we be concerned about this? We vacation down there.
Yeah. And, yeah. Gabe, it's okay. Yeah, Shane is going to dump it. That's a minor obscenity, but my apologies. Jim in Las Vegas. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Yeah. Hey, on this trade, TPP trade deal, the way I understand it, if it passes, will corporations, small and large, be able to bring foreign workers in and replace basically everybody?
Probably. The problem is that we don't know what's in the TPP. It is illegal for any of our legislators who have seen it to tell us about it, other than, you know, what they're doing is they're yelling, look out, it's bad. You can go to tradetreachery.com and you can see Alan Grayson's website all about this. But, you know, if they don't bring in foreign workers, they'll certainly move factories to foreign sites. You know, in Vietnam, where it is against the law to form a trade union, the minimum wage is 56 cents an hour. And it's against the, did I mention, it's against the law to form a trade union? And that's one of the countries involved in TPP. So this is going to be the new standard for America if this thing passes. I mean, we know at least that little bit. Jim, thank you for the call. Jeff in Portland, Oregon. Jeff, we got the last minute here. What's up?
Tom, thanks so much for taking my call. And on the eve of this fast track vote, the selling out of the American people and the selling off of our national sovereignty and democracy to the multinationals is almost complete. So, you know, today's the day for people to either speak up or relegate ourselves to the new world corporate order. And with your interview with Alan Grayson on Friday, he really pointed out that people here in the Northwest and all over could call Maria Cantwell, because if she changes her vote in Washington State, Patty Murray apparently will too. And then people in Oregon should rally and calling Ron Wyden. And that's the three votes we need to flip this thing.
Right, right. Although any of the others, Bennett of Colorado, Cardin of Maryland, Carper of Delaware, Coons of Delaware, Feinstein of California, Heitkamp of North Dakota, Kane of Virginia, McCaskill of Missouri, Nelson of Florida, Shaheen of New Hampshire, Warner of Virginia, or Wyden. Any of the rest of them could also be the deciding vote. And so I think we need to keep on all of them. You know, wherever you happen to live, you know, it's always best to call a senator who represents you. Jeff, thank you for the call. Excellent point. Excellent, excellent, excellent point. We will be back tomorrow. Thank you so much for being with us these 3 hours today. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. By the way, the number for Congress, if you want to call your senator, the vote is going to happen tomorrow if Mitch McConnell has his way on Fast Track, is 202-225-3121. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
From United Nations headquarters in New York, this is your World in Two for Friday, June.